from the Sky News Centre at 6. Hurricane Florence has left hundreds of Americans trapped in flood water within hours of hitting North and South Carolina. Winds of 90 miles an hour have left more than 500,000 homes and businesses without power. North Carolina's Governor Roy Cooper.
The storm is wreaking havoc on our state, and we're deeply concerned for farms, for businesses, for schools, and even whole communities which could be wiped away.
A teenager who murdered his stepmother with an axe and samurai sword has been sentenced to life in prison. 17-year-old Reuben Braithwaite admitted murdering Fiona Scourfield in Carmarthenshire in March. A protest by prison officers in England and Wales has been called off. Their union says it's had constructive talks with the government. Tanya Snacks reports.
Everyone's out, man.
He's got the keys, man. He's got the keys, man.
The Prison Officers Association says there's a rising epidemic of violence and drug-taking in jails and arranged protests this morning.
My members are coming out with broken eye sockets, broken jaws, head injuries. This isn't acceptable.
Labour claims the word crisis is no longer enough.
The government has caused, through their cuts to the prison service, emergency.
But the prisons minister says extra staff need time to bed down.
Bringing in 3,500 new staff understandably means that these people haven't got 5 to 10 years' experience.
More talks will be held on Monday.
Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, has agreed to cooperate with an investigation into whether Russia meddled with the US election as part of a plea deal. He's agreed to plead guilty to charges relating to consultancy work he did in Ukraine and related to the president. Ex-JLS member Arishay Williams has been charged with rape. He was arrested in 2006 over an incident with a fan in a hotel room. And it's the end of the road for a classic car. After almost 7 decades, Volkswagen is ending production of the Beetle in July. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news are Labour Councillor for Eastern, Afzal Shah, and Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police, Andy Marsh. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, as shifty-looking Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Bushirov appear on Russia Today, it turns out they are their real names, we're told. Boris Johnson and Theresa May call them murderers. But where is the evidence, the perfume bottle and the explanation why the Novichok didn't kill the targets? They presumably have evidence on these Russian bunglers, so why aren't they sharing it with us? Did the apparent nerve agent attacks on Salisbury and Amesbury originate in Portendown, chemical weapons laboratories just a few miles away, in fact right between the two towns? Is there any link to MI6 and the CIA's battle with Moscow for Idlib and for Syria, 2,500 miles away from Salisbury? Meanwhile, more Russian nerve agents are discovered in Holland, with help from the Swiss, who discovered them, trying to hack into the Swiss government's chemical weapons lab. That all happened back in March, but they've only just been told about it. Also, expert nuclear scientist Chris Busby, who's been taking the MOD on and winning in the courts, comes home to Biddeford in Cornwall this week to find a wide police cordon around his home. They say his lab is a bomb factory. Exclusive interview with Chris, plus his take on Fukushima and the Skripal case. And I'm off to Arnhem in Holland next week to look at the origins of the Bilderberg conferences for the 74th commemoration of the Arnhem Battle from the Second World War. Manfred Petrisch is here to explain possible Nazi links between then and organised crime today. Plus, Martin Summers has his chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 7 o'clock. So, helping us review this week's news are Labour Councillor for Eastern, Afzal Shah, and Chief Constable for Avon and Somerset Police, Andy Marsh. Hi, both of you. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Hello, Tony.
Now, can you, first of all, Afzal, maybe you better explain your connection to Andy Marsh. Why? What do you have to do with the Chief Constable as a councillor?
Well, I sit on the Police and Crime Panel for Avon and Somerset Constabulary. I'm one of two members representing the Labour Party from Bristol City Council.
So what did the Police and Crime Panel do?
So it's about accountability and oversight of the Police and Crime Commissioner and her role in terms of holding the force to account. But I think it's great in terms of... I've always found Andy very approachable whenever there have been any issues in the community, and I've raised them with Andy. I know that they... will be taken very seriously. I know that I've had my own issues with the police, which are a very unfortunate set of circumstances where I got arrested. I was not asked who I was. But I think it was very important to see how we can turn things around. And I certainly feel by working with Andy after my arrest, subsequent engagement thereafter, that that it's actually better to take a collaborative approach. We've got massive issues such as austerity, cutbacks on officers, a whole raft of issues. We just don't have the resources that we used to. I think that councillors like myself have a role to actually play in making sure that community policing is actually prioritised.
Look, let's talk about the bigger picture in a minute, but first of all, can you just explain the circumstances around your arrest and how it was dealt with, whether you think it was dealt with satisfactorily eventually?
So I went into Trinity Road Police Station back in April to report an offence related to two victims the previous evening by a hideous individual. I went into the station and I was told at the front desk that my complaint would not be registered because I was not the victim and I was there in proxy and someone else, although they had asked me to. And I did say that as a counsellor, so I didn't say who I was, but I said as a counsellor, it's not unusual for people to get in contact and say, can you report this? And I was told that they wouldn't. So I then asked to speak to an officer privately. I was shown to a room rather abruptly, in all fairness, and then half an hour later, a number of officers, four officers, came and I was told I was being arrested and then led out to a car. And then in that car, had a conversation with the officer. I said, look, if you're going to take me to Patchway Station, Patchway Custody Suite, by all means do so, or let's go back in. But for the benefit of the camera, you don't know who I am. You've not asked me my name, you've not asked me for ID. Then we ended up going back inside the station. Within 5 minutes, I was told that I was being de-arrested. I was told that it was because it was a case of mistaken identity. I was extremely angry about that. However, I must say, and I'm not just saying this for the sake of it, that Andy has gone out of his way to not only to apologise, but has actually said to me, look, tell me how we can make this right. And I felt that rather than moving away from the police, that I think it's an opportunity here where we can do something profoundly beneficial for the community because of the experience that I had. If I work with the chief constable and other senior officers so that they can understand how I felt and how when people approach me and they talk about institutionalized racism and these issues, the force take it seriously. And I must say, with all the interaction that I've had thereafter and with the senior officers engaging with those staff, I am thus far satisfied that we're handling things properly.
Andy, obvious thing to ask you is, was Afzal arrested because he's Asian?
Well, Afzal was arrested on the basis of a mistaken identity and very soon after that event, in fact, as soon as I was able to, I offered a fulsome apology, which I reinforced today, to be frank. One of our key values within Avon and Somerset Constabulary is about learning. And I guess, you know, I don't take the generosity of Afzal's spirit of forgiveness for granted in any respect at all. But I guess the bit that I would just want people to be mindful of that were listening is that we deal with about 8,000 calls a day, upwards of 100 to 150 domestic violence incidents, lots and lots of incidents involving ambiguity, conflict, sometimes mutual aggression. And, of course, police officers and police staff will get it wrong. Now, when we get it wrong, we should say sorry and we should learn. And our learning and will always continue. That's one of the things that holds my attention about policing. And I don't believe Afzal was arrested because he was Asian, but there are very significant issues of trust and confidence which have varying degrees within different parts of our communities. And what I will say for Afzal, he's visible and he's present and he's always ready to help us build confidence in all communities, not simply the Pakistani community, but all communities.
Now, you've had two particularly horrendous incidents over the last few years. We're talking about really the Bijam Ibrahimi case a couple of years ago, and more recently the Judah tasering. Now, both of them involving ethnic minorities. It's not looking very good. Also, there does seem to be I don't know how true this is, but it certainly seems to be that the police involved in things like, for example, tasering in the face of Judah are above the law. They don't actually lose their jobs as a result necessarily. So can you explain why that, you know, that is a perception out there that police may well be not going to lose their jobs even if they do things horrendously wrong?
Well, we could spend the whole evening talking about the case of Judah, but actually I came on the day that concluded and spoke for an hour about it. So I'm happily speak for another hour about it. But
guess, how about just in a nutshell, your thoughts about that?
Well, look, I mean, I feel we're going over old territory a bit, but the officer involved in that case went to a criminal court. The court was chaired by a very eminent judge from an ethnic minority himself. She was found not guilty in the full transparent face of the law. She then went to a misconduct hearing with an independently chaired, with a lay member of public next to the independently legally qualified chair, and she was found not to have committed any misconduct. And that took 19 months, I think, which is too long. Now, Judah was not the man that she thought he was, but I absolutely regret that we tasered him. I don't know whether you've ever been to look at our taser training, Tony. I'm giving you an invitation now. You could not taser someone in the face if you tried. That is not a high precision piece of personal protective equipment. So I'll happily talk some more about it. But you talked about, you know, shocking misdoing. I actually think that's unfair on the circumstances that have now been shown through the officer's body-worn video, shown for the first time only a week or two ago. That wasn't allowed to be shown up until then because it was evidence in two cases. So what I would always say to my police officers, I want you to walk in the member of community's shoes. I want you to feel what it's like, let's say, to be a woman who's been assaulted, or a man in their own house, to be an Asian member of the community on Stapleton Road. We need to understand our communities. But please, in return, Could we have some understanding for what is an incredibly difficult job? And I'll say one more thing on this, because I'm happily to talk about knives tonight. The amount of knives that we've seized, 2,000 in the last 2 years on the streets. I've got a horrific one here that happy to describe. That's gone up 58% in the last 12 months. Now, the people of Bristol, question here, would you want the police to be confident and proactive in trying to catch people who are carrying knives? I think you would. Now, if that isn't the case, even with the best will in the world, we're a big organisation with lots of people, we're going to make mistakes. So the deal is, we fess up and we say we're sorry. I am really sorry that Afzal was mistaken for someone else in the front office, and I regret to this day that he was arrested. I regret that Judah was tasered in the face, but actually we need our police force, and I do make a genuine appeal to you, Tony. This mustn't be a wedge between the police and the communities, because we're here for you and we need you supporting us by our side if we're to keep you safe. And Afzal's done that. He has done that, and he's got plenty to be grumpy about.
Do you think there's a perception out there that sometimes when the police do things wrong, they don't lose their jobs? That doesn't help community relations, does it?
There is a perception out there, Tony, but check our website. I sacked an officer a couple of weeks ago. So lots of police officers who do wrong lose their jobs. But police officers, like anyone else, deserve a fair process. That process is absolutely transparent, absolutely. And the body-worn video that Sue Mount Stevens funded for me to personally issue every single police officer and PCSO makes it even more transparent. And thank goodness that body-worn video was available in Judah's case, so everyone could see who wanted to make a judgment about what had happened, what had actually happened.
So, well, look, we could talk about knives in a minute, but first, how's things going with the Police and Crime Commissioner? This is basically a US import. Now, I'm always a little bit nervous about US imports, having a Police and Crime Commissioner.
I'm a Chief Constable and I've been a chief constable for almost 6 years now, and I'm in policing because I care about the public. I am incredibly proud that we're routinely unarmed and we operate with the consent and support of the public. It's a model which you won't find anywhere else in the world, including America. Now, actually, that operational independence hasn't been compromised, and it isn't for me to decide how I'm held to account. I'm held to account by a police and crime commissioner. She happens in Avon and Somerset to be democratically elected. And I think we've got a very strong and healthy working relationship with an appropriate amount of tension. She pushes me incredibly hard, and rightly so, because she acts on behalf of the public.
But it is in the US, isn't it, the similar system where they have an elected police and crime commissioner, surely?
I do believe that's where the idea originated from.
Yeah. I mean, are you happy about US imports like that? I mean, there's quite a lot of things about US policing that people in this country, particularly in this city, look across the pond and say, well, we don't like that at all.
So Tony, I am actually the United Kingdom's national lead for the National Police Chiefs Council on coordinating all international policing that we do.
Crikey.
And in the last 12 months, we've had police officers in Sierra Leone and Liberia, helping build stability and tackle conflict so that crime doesn't project itself into the UK. And I'm very proud of the work that my officers have done. South Sudan, they've been to, including that. So British policing, and I know this, has got something to learn from the rest of the world. We have got that, of course we have, and I'd be a very arrogant chief constable if I said otherwise. But one of the proudest things in moments in my career was when I was asked by, for example, Barack Obama's presidential team to advise them and him on the rollout of 50,000 body-worn cameras in America to tackle and deal with issues of legitimacy and transparency in respect of fears of excessive violence on black men in America. So I've had a lot to do with America, and of course we can learn something from them. I would never be so arrogant as to say otherwise. But I think that people globally, I know this, they beat a door to our our doorstep here to find out about how we police by consent in the UK. And that is something which I think is very precious.
These body-worn cameras, what are our rights as citizens if we feel that a police officer is doing something they shouldn't be doing? Do we have any right to that footage? Of evidence, potentially evidence.
Yeah, if an incident involves you, unless it's going to be subject of a trial, you can have access to it. And be assured, if it's not needed for evidential purposes, it will be routinely destroyed within 31 days. That actually happens automatically. We don't want to be storing stuff that we don't need. So most of it is wiped. If it's needed for a complaint or for court or some sort of tribunal, then it is kept for that reason.
Because I can remember being up in Clifton, a standoff between builders and squatters who'd occupied their building, and there was one police officer having to keep the two big crowds apart. And I was filming, and one of the builders said, "Turn that off." And the police officer said, "No, keep filming. It could be important evidence, and it's keeping them calm." So I think the idea of having cameras around can be actually decisive in stopping people doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
Tony, just a very, very quick question. I've got a bit of a responsibility because Jude is my constituent. He lives very local. This is Easton. And I was asked by a local resident to ask you on the show this evening, how will the force, how will yourselves actually reach out to Judah? And now that that we've been through the legal process regarding PC Bodie's investigation?
Yeah. Just to conclude on the body-worn video, my old police force where I was Chief Hampshire was the first big force in the world to personally issue them, and I'm the national lead on body-worn video. And what they do, in my opinion, there's evidence for this, they change people's behaviour, including the officers wearing them, for the better. They calm people down. You gave me evidence of that, Tony. They gather amazing evidence that leads to people making early admissions, early guilty pleas and better sentencing. And It is an example, and I lobbied government for the cameras to be able to be used to interview suspects, not at police stations. A great efficiency improvement, and we've implemented that. The first force in the United Kingdom to do that. I'm now working with the Home Office to see how we can use the cameras to capture statements. The technology will transform the criminal justice system as it is transforming our lives. In direct answer to Afsal's question,
yeah, the tasers aren't quite so popular, are they?
Well, I think let me ask a question here, Tony. How often do you think a taser's been discharged in Avon and Somerset in the last year?
Okay, you put me on the spot. I guess probably once a week.
So 365. Yeah, I've sold more or less.
No, 52. There's 52 weeks.
Sorry, sorry, I'm not thinking straight. Well pointing out, Tony, 50. Did I have sell?
You want me to hazard a guess?
Yeah.
I'd say probably maybe two or three times a week.
Martin?
I don't know. I've got no idea.
I'll say
a week like you.
Okay, go on then. Andy?
The 100. And that's lower than the year before. It's 111 the year before. So actually, they are a means of incapacitating someone temporarily in a way that doesn't leave any lasting injury. They've been well tested.
Unless they've got a pacemaker.
I think even with a pacemaker, there is a lot of evidence that it is an incredibly safe device. So since the incident involving Judah, which I'll come back to answer, Afsal, we've had open days for members of the community to come and look at how we train. Since then, all of our taserings and uses of force are open to scrutiny by an independent panel chaired by Desmond Brown. Not chaired by Desmond, it's a different chair, but Desmond's on it. They look at stop search, they look at use of force, they look at use of taser, they look at all of the body-worn video that's available for that. And so actually, I'd say I recognise and understand that the public are very concerned about the use of taser. I would welcome more scrutiny and open looking at how it's used and why it's used.
But Andy, they have killed people, haven't they? People have died as they've been tased, so effectively it's a lethal weapon.
I have to say that I think that's far from proven. It's not a lethal weapon, and I don't believe that there's evidence that people have directly died from its use.
Yes, well, I mean, okay.
So I don't agree to disagree
about that. Yeah. I can put a link up on our show page if you want, but several people have died as a result of being tased, I can assure you.
A small number of people have died following being tasered. I don't believe there is a direct association between the use of the taser and their obviously tragic deaths.
Oh, of course, we can't ask them.
Can we just go back to the quick question about Judah?
Yeah,
sorry,
let's get back
to Judah.
It is very
relevant.
So I need to be careful because what I have to do is respect Judah's privacy as an individual, and I wonder whether he's happy about us talking about him in this way. So,
as his local councillor, I've had people ask me in the community. Yeah. So it's just...
Maybe I should pose it as a simpler question, really. I know he was on the panel for policing, some kind of panel for policing beforehand. I would have expected that, you know, now this is all finished, the legal stuff is all finished with, that you would have approached him maybe to invite him back onto that panel, or has he been on the panel ever since? And if so, you know, what kind of amends have you made for what's happened?
So I've been working in Avon Somerset since January 2016. Judah wasn't on the panel then, and he wasn't on any independent advisory panel when this incident happened. I don't think that the question is founded on a basis of the correct starting point. As was announced at the end of the misconduct hearing, there is still a civil case outstanding which will involve the question of potential payment of some public money, taxpayers' money, let's remember that, to Judah. And so, of course, on a human level, I'd very much like to meet Judah and have a frank and open discussion about how we walk together forward as friends. But actually, I do have to be sensible about any potential liability that could be arising from civil litigation.
I
just want, I think we need to clear up that issue before we have a meeting.
Just on the taser deaths, I would suggest you Google it because there's quite a lot on there. Mostly in the United States, people who've been tasered, for example, whilst in custody and then died. But we've got just literally 8 hours ago in Wiltshire, a jury has retired to consider the verdict of an inquest on a tasered man. Terence Andrew Bennett, 44-year-old, was diagnosed with schizophrenia and manic depression, was tasered by police at his parents' bungalow in Hillwood Close, Warminster, after cutting his wrists and throat. CPR was performed, but he died at the scene. So I imagine that isn't necessarily the taser in that specific case. I can actually tell you,
Tony, I don't believe that was anything to do with the taser. I really have a concern you're misleading anyone listening to this. That was an incredibly tragic circumstance, and I think it's really inappropriate for you to link it to the use of taser.
That particular one, he was tasered as well, wasn't he?
Well, in an attempt to save his life, Tony, if you want to get into the bones of it.
Probably, yeah. But there are cases in the United States of people being tased and then dying.
If you want to have a debate about taser, get a medical expert in about the health risks of taser.
Okay, fair enough.
If you want to talk to me about disarming people who present a threat to themselves and others, talk to a police officer. But all of the medical evidence I hear is it's a very safe way of intervening where a serious threat is presented to a member of public safety, that individual safety, or the officer. And it is a tactic that a very limited number of officers in Avon and Somerset are trained for. Its use is incredibly highly scrutinised. They're trained and retrained. I understand the public concerns, but please don't mislead them about how we might be using it or what the consequences might be.
Yeah, and I apologise. That specific case was really nothing
to do
with it.
It's not an appropriate case to use.
So knives. I think we're all concerned about that. Particularly, there's been a lot of publicity this year about knife crime in London. A lot of young people seem to think that it's a good idea to carry a knife because of the threats of violence, but that really isn't your message at all, Andy, is it?
Well, I am worried about knives. So in the last 2 years, I think I've mentioned that over 2,000 have been recovered from people. I've bought a particularly horrific one that was recovered from a man who was arrested only in June, is behind me. It's a horrific looking thing. But that level of recovery of knives on the street, even with a significant lower number of officers patrolling, has gone up 50% in the last year, 58% in the last year. Now, in terms of 14 murders in the last 2 years, three quarters of them are knife related. And more than half of the knife-related ones are related to what we call county lines and drugs. So something is happening on our streets about knives and drugs. And actually, what I'm saying is we are responding to that as a police, but we really do need and welcome the support of the public and the community to help us. The people who suffer from these knife attacks are disproportionately represented within the community. So it's very much in our interest to tackle this.
How do you actually decide whether or not to stop someone and see if they're carrying a knife?
There has to be, in each and every case, and again, this is open to scrutiny by the use of powers panel, an officer has to have reasonable grounds to suspect that somebody's carrying a knife.
And what is that? I mean, is it a bulge or just maybe the way they're acting or what?
No, it would normally be that we've received information from a member of the public that an individual of a certain description has been seen with what appeared to be a knife, based on a reasonable suspicion, and there would need to be some corroboration, description, time and place. The officer will come to a judgment about whether those grounds are met, and they'll make a search. Now, in about 21% of cases where an officer decides to make a stop search, they will find a prohibited article or drugs. So that's just over a 1 in 5 positive rate.
Why is it that you think there is this big increase in knife crime? Is it simply gang related? People are maybe using it as part of their involvement with organised crime, or is it a separate issue?
I think a lot of it is gang related, and if you talk to groups of young people, they will say, some of them, that they're worried for their own safety. But actually, the statistics show the people who are victims of knife crime are very often the perpetrators of knife crime. They're the ones that go out carrying the knives in the first place. And there is a very significant issue around young people making bad decisions about knives, and we want to stop that.
If it's an increase in gang activity, isn't that also your responsibility to stop that, Andy?
Yeah, it is, absolutely.
So why is there an increase in gang activity?
Well, it's much more difficult to say there's an increase in gang activity. I can give you the hard numbers around knife crime and risk. I can't give you hard numbers around gang activity, but in terms of whose responsibility is to stop that, we haven't got enough police, Tony, to enforce those problems and issues out. This is something for parents, it's something for schools, it's social care, local authority. This is something for all of us to worry about, and that's where we need to work together.
Well, look, this sounds a good time to ask you about police cuts, because when Kevin Phillips from the Police Federation used to come in here fairly regularly, this was one of his major concerns, that we were getting cuts in PCSOs, cuts in numbers of the police, and of course that just simply means that there are always going to be priorities maybe a little bit lower down the list that simply do not get done by our police. So what is the extent of the cuts in Avon and Somerset, Andy, since 2010?
So around about 650 fewer officers, about £80 million. So the cuts have not all been represented in reductions of police officers. We've made very significant savings in other areas, including what might be regarded as some efficiency savings. We've closed a number of buildings. We've changed the way we deliver some services. But there is a second part to that story, and anyone who's really interested, I'd urge them to have a look on the website for a document called The Tipping Point, which Sue Mount Stevens and I released last autumn. It talked about how funding's changed, how police numbers have changed, what the impact is on police officers and police staff, because they're people as well, remember that. But significantly, this is the bit, how has demand changed? And we've seen sexual offences, historic sexual offences, domestic abuse, hate crime, complex crime, much of it behind closed doors, some of it involving technology and internet. We've seen those crime types pretty much double. So actually, you've got fewer police officers dealing with more complex crime in private places, particularly in respect of vulnerability. And I think one other thing has happened is that we have seen a real increase in the amount of mental ill health related incidents that we're dealing with, both in homes and on the street. And there is little doubt that many public services have shrunk. The objective is that we shrink together and not shrink apart. But the police are often the service of first resort, but I'm afraid we're the service of last resort as well. And we have picked up a quasi-social care role in respect of mental health crisis. And I hesitate to say, because it's subject to ongoing judicial proceedings, Tony, you brought up exactly one of those cases in Wiltshire, very tragic, a moment ago.
Afzal, what's your experience of this? I mean, you've been a councillor while you've seen the police numbers being decreased here in Bristol.
So I've been a councillor since 2013, representing Easton, where we are right now. Since 2010, nationally, we've lost almost 22,000 police officers. So I think that we've had enough of austerity. However, we do have huge challenges. And one thing that Avon and Somerset Constabulary has led the way in is to use analytics. I think we have to be very careful how we handle that information. But analytics itself, I think, has been a great tool in terms of making efficiencies and looking at things that we need to actually prioritise, making the best use of funds. And also with the Triforce as well, in terms of getting the best value for each pound spent locally for procurement. But certainly here, officers are expected to do far more, with far fewer resources, given the fact that, you know, Bristol is a growing city, there's changing demographics, so there are specific challenges. There's a long way to go, but I think we're up to 2.8% of police officers within Avon and Somerset Constabulary from a BME community. So there is a lot being done, but I think there's also a responsibility with communities as well. So it's a collective responsibility. And certainly, going back to the question which you asked about gangs, I really think that one of the challenges here is the lack of youth service provision, lack of youth workers. You can see it out there. And if we don't have that provision,
what about a simple thing like lack of jobs?
Lack of jobs, absolutely. Well, Bristol,
the thing is that organised crime are always going to recruit, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, Bristol, historically, it's always been a city of inequality. We are booming, but there are many people who are being left behind. So I think you're absolutely spot on that we do need to ensure that all the statutory agencies, especially the local authority, and we've got a number of initiatives in place, that we make sure that we do all we can firstly engage with these young people at a medium and a language which they understand, but offer them the opportunity for education which they may have missed out previously in school, and I know that particularly black pupils have a higher incidence of being expelled from inner city schools. That is a fact. But we do have an excellent example. We've got a gentleman called Clayton Planter. I know that he is working with yourself, Andy, as the Street to Boardroom initiative, and that's about tapping into the entrepreneurial zeal of some of these young men hanging about on street corners.
But the temptation for young people is to take the money, isn't it?
Well, I mean, so I see that every day. But I think there's also a responsibility with parents as well. I think parents need to be confident, and I would encourage them to have that conversation with the child, to ask them, how did they afford that £150 sports shoes? You don't just get it accidentally. So I think there is a collective responsibility. And one thing that I'm keen to do is to make sure that officers are reaching out. And I was at a event on Saturday organised by a local Somali organisation, where they got the youngsters to actually come and engage in a football tournament. And there were a number of police officers there. And I think that's great in terms of building bridges. But you are right. I think jobs ultimately... It is about money, it's about jobs, it's about one's future as well. If they don't have hope, then these individuals will actually tap them up. And as you know, younger children are now being used as drug mules. There was a recent report. I know that we were having that conversation.
This is a bit worrying, isn't it, Andy, when children who are below the age of normal prosecution, say, have to go to juvenile courts, and all sorts of special processes are being used in opportunistic fashion by drug dealers in order to try and get under the radar of the police?
Well, I think that's a relatively rare thing. So I wouldn't want people to be alarmed and think there's lots of 10-year-olds being abused in that way. I think
it was in the papers, wasn't it?
I didn't see it, to be honest. So I'm not disputing it happened, but perhaps not as well read. The what I would say, though, is that I think the issue is around early intervention. If you can make sure that the building blocks of society in place for very young children, and I'm talking pre-primary and primary, then actually many of these problems, I think, will be resolved. Now, we need to work with partners, pre-primary, primary, secondary, and young men and women. I mean, an example of how we're doing that in East Bristol, and we'll be launching this very soon, is called a call-in scheme, where we work with members of the community. Where a criminal case is built against a person, they will be given a stark choice, either work with a mentor, work with other agencies, not the police, to try and turn your life around with some employment and training opportunities, or go to court, and that will result in going to prison. We need to constantly give young people role models, opportunities, many opportunities to take their life in a productive direction. And I think we ought to be careful as well. There are lots of young people growing up here that do follow very productive working lives. So we still are talking about a minority of young people. Most young people are fantastic.
Well, I'm going to put some questions to you in a minute, Andy, about the financial crisis of 2008, because even Gordon Brown this week has been raising questions about why bankers are not in jail and haven't been arrested after 2008. So we'll start, though, with listen to the SNP at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, when they brought up what has happened since the 2008 financial crisis. Some call it a crash. I never call it a crash, because a crash is when the stock market goes down and everything goes. What it was simply a bailout, where the public bailed out the banks. So let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, where the SNP brought this up in the House of Commons.
Ian Blackford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A decade on from the financial crisis, the poorest in our society are still paying a price. The bankers were bailed out, but ordinary people paid the bill. IFS analysis shows that real wages are on average £800 lower. A decade on, and people are poorer.
Indeed.
A damning indictment of the UK government's leadership.
Indeed.
Tell us, Prime Minister, why have you abandoned millions of families, those just about managing?
The Right Honourable Gentleman, what we've done is created an economic environment where 3.3 million people are in work. We now see the number of children in workless households at the lowest level ever. We now also see what we have done is we've increased the national living wage. We have ensured that we've taken 4 million people out of paying income tax altogether. Over 30 million people have received a tax cut. That's what this government's been able to do by a balanced approach to the economy, keeping taxes low, putting money into public services and reducing our debt.
And now Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, can you just comment on what you make of this 10 years since the collapse of Lehman Brothers that Ian Blackford from the SNP brought up there?
Well, I think the Peter Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US economist, he's based in Texas, I believe. And what happened in the 1980s after the savings and loans collapse is over 1,000 top executives of saving and loans organisations in the US were sent to prison. And that, of course, created a sufficient deterrent to criminal behaviour at that level. What's happened this time is that because there have been such a lot of basically criminal behaviour, rigging things like the LIBOR rate and so on, and I do understand that it's very difficult for the police to investigate these cases. We've had ex-police officers here from the fraud squad in London talking about how tricky it is to get these cases through. But of course, it's fundamental. If you don't do that, you then create a situation where you've got moral hazard and they think they can get away with it. So, you know, HSBC gets fined for basically working with the Zetas cartel in Mexico. But Lord Green, who becomes a minister in Britain rather than being punished. And of course, in Mexico itself, López Obrador, who's just won the election, is definitely considering legalization of drugs as a way to try and stop the massive violence that's going on surrounding the drugs industry. But I realise these are huge questions and they're not going to be resolved at chief constable level, but these issues are underpinning lots of things.
Before we go to Andy, what's your take on the 10 years, though? It's been 10 years since this. Have we clawed back at all? Okay, so we've got the bankers are still running around who should have been in jail, but have we actually clawed the economy back at all? We're not hearing very good signs, are we, from the police?
What's actually happened is they've now built a bigger bubble than was in 2008. There's far more debt out there than in 2008. Interest rates have been reduced to zero. We've spent lots of money on quantitative easing, and of course the danger now with what's the collapse in Turkey and Argentina, Brazil looks as if it's going the same way. It's all going to go down the drain again, and of course there won't be a bailout this time in the same kind of way because they haven't got the resources unless they go and take the money off the people who've made the money in the last 10 years, and that does come down to criminal prosecutions.
What do you mean they haven't got the resources? They're making up this QE $100 billion.
What they've done is they're not following a free market textbook by doing that. But the point I mentioned Galbraith earlier is he said you've got to actually punish those involved with prison terms. Fines for their organisations isn't enough. This is control fraud. The people who are running the banks are basically running the banks for their own benefit. And if the bank gets fined, that's not really a problem. But I can't remember the name of the officer we had on previously talking about when they were going after the princes in the city.
This is Rowan Bosworth Davis. He was the detective in the fraud squad, wasn't he?
That's right. He was a detective in the fraud squad. But of course, these are very difficult to investigate.
I seem to remember he had something to say about Hargreaves Lansdowne, but we better not go into any detail.
He said they've been interviewed under caution several times.
Libelous. So anyway, Andy, the bigger picture here is, obviously, this is going on in the City of London. That's not your jurisdiction. But there are a lot of people out there wondering why, and Gordon Brown included, why some of the bankers from 2008 haven't been prosecuted.
Well, I guess we're talking about sometimes the difference between morality, social justice and the law. So Parliament passes the law and the police enforce it, and I recognise that's the case. I don't know that there are crimes made out by the banking collapse.
False accounting is one, obviously. If you're saying your bank is worth X and it's got these assets, and that is just simply not the case, as we had with HBOS, for example, surely that's criminal.
Yeah, I'm not ducking the question, Tony. I haven't had the evidence presented to me. I would like to think like you. I mean, we're all sitting here. If people made a lot of money and committed crimes, that they would be held to account. I stand for justice, fairness, and the rule of law. And if you think about my own position, the thousands of people who work for me, like the rest of our community, nurses, doctors, teachers, people in the private sector. I do know about police officers. Their real pay has been suppressed about 15% in the last 10 years. So I think we've all felt the brunt of this. I'm not going to sit here and stick up for anyone who might have broken the law, but I'm not aware of that evidence, Tony.
Maybe I should email you with an article about HBOS, just as one example. Seems to me what's going on is you've got companies who are being talked up, if you want. So when there's a flotation on the stock exchange, the idea is that if you say the thing is worth much more than it really is, then you can make a lot more money from the flotation. And also, if you're selling a business, you can make it look as if on paper it's worth a lot more than it really is. And what we've heard actually back in February from Mervyn King, the former Bank of England governor this year, is that the debt, that is to say the amount that's on those balance sheets, which is funny money, which won't be paid, is around about something like £166 trillion. Now, that's a lot of money. So if the bubble bursts, it's going to go bang in quite a big style. But anyway, what can you just explain how, say somebody out there, say for example me, wants to write into the police and saying I think that this company has got fraud going on within it and that the accounts are fixed, etc. Who do we contact? Because I guess it's not you, it would be someone in London, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so actually we have got lots of investigators, including people who work in financial fraud and economic crime in Avon and Somerset. Not lots, we've got small numbers of those. And we've got some real experts. But actually fraud, particularly cyber-enabled fraud, that's the new stuff, is pretty epidemic. And when you talk to people about whether they've been victims of crime or not, you know, hopefully most people say, well, not in the last year, hopefully. But actually, most people will have experienced some sort of phishing email, a dodgy phone call trying to get them to log on to something, or an effort to scam money off them. Now, the way in which people should report that is through action fraud. And action fraud can be reported by telephone or online. Action fraud have got protocols with all of the 43 forces in the UK, and they refer, I believe, about 100 crimes a month to us for further investigation. Most of the work they do is working with other agencies and government to switch off the means by which individuals and fraudsters are trying to exploit people. So that's how it works.
What about this whole idea of being too big to jail, as we just heard about HSBC? I mean, they were prosecuted in the United States, not here, for money laundering on a massive scale with the Mexican drug cartels. It's actually a UK-based company, but its activities in the US were prosecuted, but not here. Is there such a thing, do you think, as too big to jail?
Well, we hear, don't we, about the odd cases, I mean, libel fixing being a case in point, that, and it sounds as though Martin's a real expert here, so we might want to bring him in. But so we do hear about big cases of fraud where people are convicted. And actually, I do know that my colleague, the Commissioner of the City of London Police, is that they are the UK national lead on major financial fraud. And they are widely recognised as global leaders on financial fraud. So perhaps we can persuade the Commissioner to come on and have an interview sometime.
Doing it or investigating it?
They do investigate. I guarantee you they investigate it.
Because around about £100 billion is being made up out of nowhere at the moment by the Bank of England. Surely that Mark Carney should have the handcuffs slapped on him for counterfeiting, shouldn't he?
I'm not an economist. I'm curious whether money can be created or destroyed. You know, is there such thing as not real money? I mean, Martin, if somebody benefits, surely someone must lose, and if someone loses, someone must benefit. Isn't that the way it works?
What's happened is with quantitative easing, the money goes basically to goose the stock market.
It's printing
money,
isn't it, Martin? It's printing money, basically.
Well, yeah, but it's not printing because there's no printing involved. It's electronic. But what it does is it gooses the stock market artificially to keep it going. And of course, that then runs into people's bank accounts who are beneficiaries of that sort of thing. And then what they do is they stick it in the Cayman Islands or whatever. So all the money that's gone from your budget does still exist, but it's gone to the Cayman Islands because of this way of trying to deal with the problem that we're dealing with.
I can almost hear from Portishead a couple of police officers booking tickets to the Cayman Islands right now.
Can I just say that this is a real... When Rowan Bosworth Davis was on here, and he used to work for the fraud squad in the Met, he said that what they went for is for what you might call symbolic targets, people at the top of the chain who've been doing it for years. They were very well connected, what he called the princes in the city.
These were people from County Net West
Bank, in other words, he wanted to get them because then that would intimidate all the others further down who were a smaller fry. And they had to work very hard because it's making these things stick in front of a jury, as you can imagine, is really difficult. They have to get all the evidence and it's very hard to do. But he resigned eventually because the judge, after they put all this effort in to get this individual, the judge then, who went to the same school as the individual, then just let him walk. And at that point, he resigned from the Met, and he's been, you know, he writes journalism.
And he's a lecturer in one of the London universities.
He's a lecturer in
criminology,
isn't he? That's right.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Gordon Brown saying this. In fact, I was rather disappointed that they didn't have this on the main BBC broadcast, but they did have it on the World Service. So let's have a listen to what Gordon Brown had said about financial criminals this week, the former Prime Minister.
Many of these bankers should have gone to prison. They had broken the law. They had not operated in a way that was consistent with the ethics of the banking system of the world. And we have laws that now talk about reckless misconduct. One of the great sadnesses of this is that you will never learn from the mistakes unless it is clear that action has been taken when these people have gone against the rules and the regulations of the financial system. And until I think we are clear that we have proper laws that will find those people who are responsible guilty, then the public will think that the bankers got off with it and that they're going to do exactly the same thing again.
Martin Summers, that's actually quite a stark warning from the man who was there at the time. In fact, he said, didn't he? I seem to remember him saying, "I saved the world" in the House of Commons. I don't think he really did he?
Well, I mean, the you could argue, and the Austrian school economists still argue, and they may be right, that you shouldn't bail the banks out, you should just let them collapse. But of course, if you're not going to do that, then you've got to bail them out, and then you've got to actually control them, and that's what's not happened. I think there is an issue about crime here. As I mentioned earlier, Galbraith, who's an economist who's looked into this. If you don't actually punish people, they don't take it seriously. I mean, basically, they treat the fines they get given as a cost of doing business. And that given the amount of money that they made from the Zetas cartel, the H-Boss's fine was nugatory. And therefore, the only thing that really intimidates them is the fear of going to prison with other low-life criminals who will give them a hard time. And I think you needed to see that. In the 80s, that's what happened. That's what happened in the US. About over 1,000 executives were sent to prison. And it doesn't have to be long sentences, but they've just got to go.
Right on cue, Martin mentions prisons because they've come up this week again with all sorts of problems last week and the week before at Birmingham Prison, which has been run by G4S. The government have now moved in to take that over. But last night on BBC Question Time, we had the prisons minister, Rory Stewart, giving his verdict on whether G4S should have been given that contract in the first place, whether it works to have privatised prisons or not. And there were another couple of guests as well, just before he spoke, making their points about privatisation.
You sit at the very back there on the left. Yes.
Yes, I mean, if you've got private businesses in charge of running prisons, their priority is always going to be shareholder value. Yeah. It's never going to be the safety or the rehabilitation of the people in their care.
OK. And... you, sir.
No. Hi, I'm an MOD firefighter, and the government have just announced the award of the contract to take over the fire service for the Ministry of Defence at a cost of £550 million to Capita. The government themselves tend to give contracts to G4S, Serco, Capita, Carillion, who have just cost the taxpayer £148 million, 2,300 jobs. Do you not think it's about time that public assets were put back to the public?
OK, Rory Stewart now. No, sir, you're the prisons minister. You said you'll resign in a year if there isn't a substantial drop in drug use and violence in jails. What do you say specifically to the point of G4S and the others are not the right people to be running the prisons?
Okay. So there are two separate issues here. One is the question about private people in prisons, and the other is the question about the conditions in prisons, which a gentleman asked. The answer is that it is not an ideological debate here. We have bad private prisons. Birmingham is a bad prison run by G4S. And we've just taken it back in control by the government. But some of the best local prisons in the country are run by the private sector.
So anyway, Rory Stewart, the prisons minister, goes on there to explain why actually it makes nothing to, it's nothing to do with whether a prison is private or not as to whether its standards are kept up. Afzal Shah, what do you make of this whole idea of privatising prisons? G4S don't have an amazing track record on this sort of thing.
I think ultimately we should be looking at prevention. Prevention really is better than crime. I think there's a statistic from the ONS that for every individual who's incarcerated, looking at an average cost of £38,000 per year. So, and that is taxpayers' money. So I think an intervention and looking for how we can stop people ending up in prison in the first place. However, there are certain offences that you know, people need to be incarcerated with. It should not be driven by profit. This should be the responsibility of the government, but unfortunately the austerity agenda that we have seems to be focused on the bottom line rather than ensuring that people are in prison and they are given courses and vocation to actually learn something new so that when they do leave prison that they can actually go into an environment where they can get back into work. And I think that needs to be the priority as opposed to businesses coming in, just cutting costs and just being answerable to the shareholder.
Now, Andy Marsh, Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police, I realise this is not, you're not responsible for the prisons, but if the prison service doesn't get it right, you're just going to see people coming back onto the streets again and again and back gaining the attention of your officers and going through the courts and back to prison again.
Yeah, and actually, there's been a prison dispute today, hasn't there? And actually, we stood up, the police stood up, ready to deal with any potential security breach or disorder that might take place. And so there is an impact beyond the prison. And it is of great grief to everyone involved, including police officers, when they see individuals go into prison and come out and reoffend. I think it causes even greater grief when we see their children enter the same cycle. So I'm fully with AFSAL, and the absence of crime is the best indicator of an effective police force.
But are you with Rory Stewart when he says it doesn't make any difference whether it's privatised or not?
I think the issue of privatisation is a political one and not really for a police officer to comment
on. What about the police, though? Some police services have been private. You've seen even some police officers or departments of police forces have G4S officers. Is it Durham or somewhere like that? You probably know better than I do. We're starting to see private policing, really.
Many police forces privatise certain functionality, and I've tended not to in the two police forces I've led, although there are aspects of my police force which are privatised. So, for example, the catering. We've only got one canteen, but two, actually. Sorry, one at Bridgewater as well. But It's all about public value. Now, I would actually defend the operational independence of the police to my dying breath. I do believe that police services should be provided for all. And actually, I do believe that we should be there for people who don't have a voice in society. So the vulnerable, including children. That's why I'm a police officer. And I don't believe that you will get those sorts of services through the privatised means.
Martin Summers, Prisons Minister Rory Stewart today said the action of prison staff, the protest today outside prisons, peaceful demonstrations, was illegal.
Well, yes, it is illegal, but nevertheless, I think they've made their point, and they need to make it. In the US, where the private prisons were pioneered in the 1980s, the CIA...
Can I just make it clear why they were there? What they were saying was, Prison Officers Association said, safety within prisons, saying they'd been attacked by gangs of inmates, been spat at and had urine thrown at them whilst on duty, and that they'd had enough of it.
Well, it's always going to be a difficult job, isn't it? And, of course, you've got to provide the resources. Norway has got the best stats for people who go to prison and do not reoffend in Europe. But they spend... Their prisons are state-of-the-art. They focus on rehabilitation. They haven't got people banged up 24 hours a day in unsuitable premises and so on. I mean, but again, they've got their oil there, and that gives them the resources to do it properly. And they've got the best stats in Europe.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks very much to our guests, Labour Councillor for East and AFSAL Shah, also Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police, Andy Marsh. Join us after the news as we look at the Skripals and
this
the global picture.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol,
bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.